We had a lively interest in whatever the administration was doing with respect to church and state.
This is something that we fought hard for.
Religious liberty is one of the hallmarks and part of the bedrock of American democracy.
We at the BJC like to say when anyone's religious liberty is threatened, everyone's religious liberty is at risk. Welcome to the BJC podcast. I'm Amanda Tyler, the executive director of the BJC, and I'm here today with General Counsel Holly Holman to talk about our experience at the Supreme Court for the oral arguments in the case that's known as the American Legion versus American Humanist Association. So welcome, Holly.
Glad to be here.
Thanks. So we were here talking about our involvement in this case because BJC did file a friend of the court brief in this case, as we often do, and oral arguments were on February 27th. So we were out at the court yesterday for these arguments. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about our experience?
Sure. Those of you who know the BJC have seen our work and often might see pictures of us out in front of the court as we leave the courtroom and come down and have a chance to speak to the media. But the fun part is really before we go in, when you're lining up and excited to get in the courtroom and mingling with people from the church state bar and maybe other attorneys that we know, and looking forward to getting your seat in the courtroom and kind of sizing things up. Yesterday was particularly busy, the day of the oral arguments, in that there was a good crowd and we had to wait out in the freezing cold, and the public line was really long. That's the line where members of the public can get in and watch oral argument. Amanda and Jennifer and I were able to be in the Supreme Court bar line, which is shorter and allows us to sit in the special bar section, and we were glad that all three of us got to make it into the courtroom.
And we only had to get there at 7 a.m. for 10 a.m. argument. I heard there were some people in the public line who got there at 4 a.m. and couldn't get in. So
it seems to be more and more popular for people to try to get in the courtroom. And as some people don't know, it's a pretty small room. So it's a very intimate feeling kind of experience to be in the courtroom during arguments.
And of course, still, they don't allow any cameras in the room, so the only way to see it is to be there.
That's right.
So this was our first time to see this particular court, right? Because Justice Kennedy has retired, Justice Kavanaugh is now on the bench. What were some of the impressions of the argument that you had?
Yes. I was struck by that as well when you enter the court and kind of see the new lineup, because the most junior member, the newest member of the court, sits on the far side, and that's so that you have kind of you can have sort of this rearrangement of seating because they sit by seniority with the chief in the middle. And the arguments were interesting from the very beginning, and not just, of course, it would be interesting to us, but they were super engaging. And I felt like all of the members of the court that spoke, you could tell that they were really thinking about and engaging with the advocates on the issues. Now, like you say, we should be able to expect that. But in our area of the law, in church-state matters, and especially the way the BJC approaches it from such a fundamental, personal, religious perspective, sometimes we worry that people don't really understand why these things are important, why it's important to have rules that would actually keep religious symbolism on government property to a minimum and would not allow things like a big cross on public land.
Yeah, and I actually was struck. I've heard this case described as one of the marquee cases of this term. And as we watched people filing in, I saw a couple of the justices' wives attended. Chief's wife was there. Justice Kavanaugh's wife was there. So there was a lot of interest, I think, even among the court's family.
That's interesting.
In this oral argument.
Yeah, I noticed a former clerk of the court came back to see it. I know that he's retired and lives in the area, and I thought, well, it was good enough to bring him back.
Right.
It was a hot bench from the very beginning. It starts off.
What does that mean, hot bench?
Yeah. So it starts off with the petitioner, the team that lost below gets to argue first. And in this case, we had very experienced advocates representing the petitioner side. That's the side that was saying that this cross should stay up. It started off with an advocate named Neil Katyal, who has a long experience, argued many cases at the court, used to be in the SG's office, actually worked under Elena Kagan.
And SG is Solicitor General.
In the Solicitor General's office, that's right. And he began forcefully saying why this almost was no big deal. Of course this cross should remain because of its long-standing history, its dedication to the veterans of World War One, but he had to say in his first 4 points, which were quite concise, that the display lacked religious content. And I knew from there he was not going to get to continue for long. And sure enough, he was interrupted quite soon. And that's what I mean by a hot bench. You had early on Justice Sotomayor, Ginsburg, and Sotomayor going back and forth, really pushing him on the nature of this display, its religious nature, as well as how he described the setting. As people may recall, if they listened to our earlier podcast or followed the news, this is a cross that is in a busy intersection. And when you come upon it in your car, it's just a 40-foot cross. True that there's an emblem of the Legion on the cross in the middle, and there's some other plaques and things at the bottom, but you can't really see them from the roadway and the way you approach it. And so he got questioned right away about whether this could properly be seen as part of a larger memorial park, which is their argument, because you really would not experience it that way as you come into it.
Yes, as a reminder to our listeners, we have lots of information about this case and our involvement in this case on our website, bjconline.org/crosscase. And the crux, no pun intended, of our brief is really standing up for the religious meaning and the religious nature of the cross. So it did strike me that from the very beginning, the advocates on the other side were clinging tight to their interpretation of the cross as a secular symbol.
That's right. They argue that it has an objectively secular meaning. And Justice Sotomayor, very early in the argument, said that there's a brief here that says that to deeply religious Christians, secularizing the cross is blasphemy. Christ died on the cross. He was resurrected from his grave. So those people don't view secularizing the cross as something that's okay. So
those people, who are those people,
those
Holly?
Those people are the Baptist Joint Committee for Religious Liberty, along with the United Church of Christ, the Presbyterian Church USA, the stated clerk of the General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church USA, as our friends joined this brief, along with the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. Our brief was also joined by the American Jewish Committee and the Central Conference of American Rabbis. And that was because we know as Christians, the cross has a very specific meaning tied to the story of Jesus, as Sotomayor could say confidently from probably her experience. I know that she is was raised Catholic, but had our brief right there to show this. Obviously, it's also very true to our Jewish friends who joined in this brief that they experience the cross as an important, significant religious symbol, that they respect that is the Christian tradition and can say, and that is not my tradition. So right away, the court got to this issue about whether the government could use a cross and to memorialize Christians and others, which when you're memorializing the service of veterans, it would be unusual to claim that you memorialize that they were all of one faith.
Yeah. So, I mean, Holly, as you and our colleague Jennifer Hawks, who worked so hard on this brief, along with, of course, Professor Douglas Laycock, who was the counsel of record, principal author of our brief, you worked so hard on this. It must have been thrilling to hear your words coming out of the justice's mouth at certain times in this argument.
Well, we appreciate the opportunity to have resources to be able to continue the Baptist witness that has always stood for religious liberty for all. So it's an honor to do this work and to have built a reputation and to be able to learn from colleagues, to work with such professionals as Professor Laycock, and to have the respect of the court that you know they're going to read our brief. And then to hear it being accurately cited or used to engage the advocates, of course, is what we want. We want to make sure that the court considers these arguments. And in this case particularly, you know, because this cross has been up for so many years, and because in its throughout those years, people had asserted it was for World War I veterans, we knew it would be there would be sympathy toward this idea to leave it alone. But we couldn't ignore that it is at odds with a very important principle in Establishment Clause jurisprudence in our First Amendment protections for religious liberty, and that's the idea, the principle that the government cannot choose between Christians and Jews or other religions and promote one faith over the other. And this cross, just looking at it, appears to do that. And so it was important that we got involved in the case, and we stood up for that principle, and that we called the government out on its claim that we think is really hard to swallow, and that is that the cross, even though it has religious significance, which they would say it does, that it somehow had become secularized and was objectively secular because the government had dedicated it to veterans.
Yeah, and you had mentioned that, you know, the first of three advocates made that point for the petitioner's side, but we heard that repeated right in the second, from the second advocate and the third advocate, too.
We did. So the first advocate represented the county entity, the by-county entity where the cross stands. The second advocate represents the Legion and made a much more aggressive argument. Wasn't just saying that this cross was okay and could stay there, but said that could do that under any test and that the court should change the test. And you don't need to think about Lemon, the test that the court has established a long time ago in these cases, or any other kind of the known test, but should take advantage of this case to basically reduce the Establishment Clause to a coercion test, which people make that argument from time to time. And I think in this case, some really want to make it because they want to say, oh, this is just a passive monument. It's just there, not hurting anyone, as opposed to sending the signal or sending the message to all of the residents that pass by it that, you know, the government's taking a position on Christianity. But this second advocate for the Legion argued that the court, that it didn't matter. The court could uphold the cross, and a government could pick and choose between religions as long as it didn't make someone do something. But his argument was not, it did not seem to be well received by the court. It was sort of confusing. Was it a coercion test, he was saying, or was it an anti-excessive proselytizing test? And so the court kind of went around and around, and I don't think he advanced his side's argument very well. Then the third advocate we were very interested in was representing the United States government. So the U.S. government decided to come in on this case to make their opinion known, and unfortunately stuck to that line that a government can put up a cross and in the context of calling it a war memorial, that it would somehow have a purely secular meaning and therefore be consistent with the religious liberty clauses.
Yeah, and the government, the U.S. government's attorney making the statement not once but twice that the cross had taken on some kind of secular meaning was really quite jarring to me.
It was. People may recall the last one of the most recent church state cases was Greece v. Galloway. It was a case about legislative prayer, or prayer before town council meetings, and it extended this rule, this tradition of legislative prayer before state legislatures and Congress, and it extended that to town councils. And the BJC had problems with that. We didn't want to make participation in prayer part of direct democracy in the town council setting. And the court, we had some influence in that case too. Unfortunately, we were cited in the dissent instead of the majority. But in that case, the court upheld this tradition of legislative prayer and extended it to local government. But what was really important there is that the court, I think, did that in sort of accommodating the needs of communities that wanted to have prayer, as long as that prayer was not discriminatory. Basically, if anyone could pray in the forum or give some kind of invocation, that the court allowed that. So that doesn't violate the Establishment Clause. So there was an element of private speech there and an element of required inclusivity. It was jarring to hear the United States argue that this was just like Greece. When you have a standalone Christian symbol, permanent, this is government speech. It wasn't the speech of individuals, and it was not something that was open to inclusivity.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's not surprising they would be citing Greece because that's the most recent case, but the facts there really are so different from what we have in this case.
They are. And as we know, and people who practice in this area know, the court has used different tests to determine whether something violates the Establishment Clause, that clause that says Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. And then it goes on, of course, to say, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And there's not one test the court has applied, but they've looked to the meaning and the, they've looked to history for sure, but they've also looked to government interest and effect and context. And people, including many justices, will criticize the test as being unworkable or complicated or confusing. And the BJC has worked hard to take up for the tests as they fit the principles. And it was interesting. That's part of why I think the bench was so aggressive, is they were trying to figure out, do we need a new test? Is there a new test? Under what test should this cross stay or go? And what will be the effect on all the other cases?
Yeah, and the test that they most were interested in is what's been called the Lemon Test, for the name of the case. And sometimes people call it the infamous Lemon Test. And there was a lot of colorful language from the justices about it. But like you, they didn't seem to be gravitating to any better alternative.
That's right. That is certainly true. And it did seem like some of them were eager to, and they had these three very experienced advocates giving them options, and they were not very satisfactory. Right. And then you had Monica Miller, a young woman who is counsel for the American Humanist Association, who, Amanda, we were talking about this earlier, right? What was your impression of her from your seat, pretty close to the council table?
Yeah, had a great seat kind of right in the middle in front of Chief Justice Roberts, and I watched all the team for the other side, the three advocates, come in with their supporting attorneys and their boxes and boxes of materials. And then we saw Monica Miller alone at council table with a pretty a much smaller stack of materials. It reminded us of, I was talking to Jennifer, whispering to Jennifer before the argument started, reminded us of David versus Goliath. this was her first time to argue before the court. She's only, I think, 5 years out of law school. Many attorneys spend their entire career without arguing before the Supreme Court. You know, maybe she only has down to go from here, but this was a great place for her to start. I was really impressed with her ability before the court.
She did, I think by all accounts, she did a really good job. And it's not that we should be surprised by anyone. When they argue in front of the Supreme Court, you should be prepared. You've thought about all the questions. You probably had a lot of practices. But I think with so much at stake in this area of the law, I think some people were nervous about this being someone's first argument. But Monica quickly took advantage of the weaknesses in the other side. She started her argument, I thought, really powerfully. As our brief reflects, and many on those that were filed in support of maintaining our religious liberty standards and against government support of this cross, we emphasize that it's the clearest command of the Establishment Clause that you cannot prefer one religion over the other. So we often argue about, you know, what does government neutrality mean and how much can you accommodate historic practices and things like that. But we really don't like to see this clear principle being questioned. And so she came out very strong, citing that principle and saying that the government was essentially arguing that the cross was non-religious, a non-Christian symbol that honors everyone. And then she said, yet I don't think anyone here would deny that it would be unconstitutional, as well as inappropriate, to go into Arlington Cemetery and place a Latin cross over the grave of every person there, every fallen soldier, irrespective of their religion. I think that was really powerful. There have been a lot of people who try to confuse this case and act like that if you take down this cross, you're going to scour religion from the public square, which is, of course, not true. And you have to draw lines. And so I think that was a powerful way of really calling the other side on this sort of extremeness of their argument.
Yeah. The other side, I thought something else that really lent to her success, at least at the argument, we don't know what the outcome of this case is yet, but the other side had experience under their belt, multiple arguments before the Supreme Court. She had experience with this case.
Exactly.
This had been her case to litigate from the beginning, and she knew that record backwards and forwards and really could respond to the arguments and the questions of the justices, I thought, in a very effective way.
She did. She knew the record very well, and that was important in this case because we knew that there would be members of the court that would be very concerned that a ruling against this particular display would have wide-reaching effects that would take down lots of other displays and that the public would not understand that. And as Justice Alito quite directly put it, what message would that send? Once the argument got to that point where the court was really engaging in what it should do because of history and because of its perception of the outcome, I felt really good that we had done our part, that the court had seen that it is not correct, it is not fair, it's not right to say that a cross stands for Christians and Jews and others be outside Christianity, and so that was the good part of the oral argument. Of course, as we compliment and her performance and that she was able to answer the questions well and sort of not be bothered by the aggressiveness of the justices, we know that this is a hard case that we've seen already in the media reports that most people say that the court was looking for a way to uphold this particular display. Perhaps this one, without making a broad statement that would change Establishment Clause standards or that would open the door for new crosses being displayed today. And on that point, I think Justice Kagan was really, really helpful. She has experience in arguing cases. She had served in the Obama administration when there was an issue about a cross on public land that had been transferred to private land in order to avoid a constitutional challenge. And she kept asking the government if it would be okay, if they say that this cross is okay, it would be okay to do today. And so that was interesting that throughout the argument, we sort of got to that point of, okay, is it possible for the court to write an opinion that might somehow sort of grandfather this cross, perhaps because of the historic nature that it's been there for 90 years, and but for the court to write an opinion in a way that doesn't open the door for governments today to choose a particular symbol and say that it stands for all people.
Yeah, and I think we found that encouraging, right? That at least it seemed like, and it's always, a little dangerous to try to guess from what happens at oral argument, but it seemed like they were trying to draw a line between what had happened and what would go forward.
That's right. And I think that was hopeful. Now, we still don't know, but it did feel like the court understood that it would be problematic today to put up a cross for and say that it stood for non-Christians. New Justice Kavanaugh actually read from the brief in support of the Jewish war veterans that said that they didn't feel like the cross represented them, and that by putting it up and saying it did, that it violated the core commitments of our country. And so I think he was recognizing that it's problematic. The government's argument that a cross is secular is problematic. Now, whether that means Justice Kavanaugh or anyone else will write an opinion or sign on to an opinion that holds firmly to this principle that we hope they do, the principle that the government cannot pick and choose between religions and advance one over the other. I think how they write the opinion will be influenced by that.
Yeah. So the argument's over now, and we all stand up and exit the courtroom. What can you give us a sense a little of what happened after the argument? Because our day wasn't over at that point.
Sure. Since so few people are in the courtroom, there's the whoever can get in, and people get there early, and the guests of the advocates, and the press corps that covers the Supreme Court are there. But you come out, and that's where more of the press can find out what happened in the courtroom and can talk to people who are there to fill out their stories that they'll be reporting to the public the next day. So we typically come down and see the bank of microphones and have the chance to make a statement, and we always want to make a statement that that states our values and why the case is important, and make sure that people know that the Baptist Joint Committee for Religious Liberty continues to stand up for the separation of the institutions of religion and government and religious freedom for all people, and that particularly in this case, that people would hear that this case is not just important to humanists and non-Christians who feel feel like outsiders in their political community, feel like they are being, they're hurt by the assertion that there would be a monument to memorialize veterans that excludes them so clearly. And so it's important that we have our voice out there. So we come to the microphone and make a statement, and Nina Totenberg from NPR is always right there, and she has the microphone in my face and reminds me to look at the cameras, which is just part of the fun atmospherics of that day.
And Nina actually quoted you in her story that she ran on NPR.
She did, and that's nice because NPR, we know, runs all over the country in different times and places, and so yeah, I get a text from someone who was in North Carolina saying she heard us. So that's a good thing, and we're glad because we know that while we think about these issues all the time, and people who support the Baptist Joint Committee and are historic Baptists that really care deeply about this and support our organization, it's important to us, but we know there are many people who would be with us but haven't considered our perspective. And so every time we're quoted in the media, we hope it helps advance religious liberty by having people remember why America has had this commitment and how it has been really good for not just Baptists, but religion in general, and keeping the peace among people of different faiths and of no faith.
Yeah, and we were grateful that our friends at American Humanist Association, who actually brought this case, they hosted a rally with a microphone for lots of different speakers to come and talk about why they supported their side of this case. And so I had an opportunity, while you were talking to the press, to go and speak at their rally and share our message about why we, as Christians, were standing with them as non-Christians in all saying that, no, this cross does not stand for everyone.
That's right. That's right.
So now this case is submitted, and I think we will all be watching. Because it's one of these marquee cases, these cases come down the last week, but we'll see. But sometime in June, probably, we'll have a decision in this case.
Yes, we will. And we'll stay tuned and hope for the best. But we know that whatever the court decides, that our work will continue to be important to stand up and remind government that it really does religion no favors when it tries to get involved in determining, what religion is right and true, whether a symbol that so clearly represents the story of God's love and Jesus' life and death and resurrection, whether that's something that should be believed in and promoted. It's really not the business of the government. And we saw in this case how damaging it is for the government to be involved in this, because they will inevitably send this message that we are not equal citizens, that we are not equal citizens without regard to religion, which is, of course, a core element of who we are as Americans, or they'll try to distort a religious symbol to say that it has some different meaning. And of course, that's offensive and hurtful to the way that religion interacts in our culture and the way we all interact with each other.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a fascinating case, of course, and want to thank you, Holly, for all of your amazing work in this case, and also for joining us on the podcast today.
Thank you.
And for our listeners who want to learn more or see photos of us in action at the court, you can go to bjconline.org/crosscase.
And for more conversations from the BJC, subscribe to our iTunes channel or go to bjconline.org/podcasts. Thanks for joining us, and be sure to follow the BJC on social media to keep up with the latest religious liberty news.